Okay, yeah. The Gabrot line or G line, that is a well-established thing. That is similar to a waveguide-type mode, as Wesley said, a surface wave that will propagate on a single conductor. And, of course, it doesn't work down to DC. It has a cutoff, a low-frequency cutoff, where below which you won't get propagation. That's well established. That's it's almost like a kind of waveguide mode that exists. And you have these launchers where you see the actual field lines will terminate either ahead or behind the wave as it propagates on this single conductor. So that is well established. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you, John. We were talking about that back in Dick's day, about the mechanism. There was some discussion that it's relatively lossless or something. I forget the details, but it's a legitimate thing. It's not used because it has a significant amount of limitations, unless you know better. My understanding, it was a kind of a scientific novelty that really didn't lend itself to commercial manufacture.
I think one of the things is the problem of the launching of it. You require this conical structure to launch it. If you're going from coax to single conductor, and then you have this similar conical structure to convert back to, if you want to go back to coax. So for that reason, I think it pretty much is not used. I don't know of any cases where it's used.
Yeah, I mean, that was my understanding as well. I don't say that there's no such things as surface waves. I have a problem with the specifications of Zenik waves and a tendency of whenever I see a professor give a lecture and mention Zenik wave, he always seems to put air quotes over it, which makes me feel as though there's something wrong there, but I don't know. But there are plane waves and there are G lines. It's just the idea of extracting zero point energy from the vacuum, vacuum point energy, which you can't do because you got to kind of transfer energy from a high gradient to a low gradient. And since zero point energy is the lowest point, there's no way of moving it anyplace. So, but there are other reasons why people say that they can extract energy from curious places that no one has done before. But we'll see what you think of this circuit. I'm really curious to see what you make of it.
Okay. You cannot put everything, zero point of energy, whatever, everything into the one basket and make a borscht, Ukrainian borscht. Because that one made by Ukrainian is tasty, and that one that you're trying to make is just a pure chaos. Surface plasma polaritron or Zenik wave is exactly the same. It is only the frequency that is being assigned, or the fiber optic is exactly the same. It is dealing with the frequency of that is very specific, and that's why they call it service plasma polaritron. They don't call it, let's say, the Zenik wave, but it's exactly the same phenomena. So Zenik wave is actually something that is assigned to much lower frequency than service plasma polaritron. So when I sent you that video, there was a solid science and solid practice because it is being used. In microstrips, they use a waveguide that is using a surface wave. When you have a problem with something, you cannot put zero point energy into it because you make a borscht. So there was a certain field of science that is a very narrow and needs somebody to know the alphabet of it. And alphabet of it is just the names that describe the same phenomena at different frequencies. Thank you, XGS.
Okay, Wes. Anything else?
Comment?
Sure.
Yeah, no, what Wesley mentioned, he mentioned an interesting point there when you said the same phenomena at different frequencies. This is what happens a lot when you start talking about the comparison with fiber optics and waveguides. As you say, like a fiber optics is really just a waveguide at optical frequencies. And how Dick used to describe the waveform, you know, ping-ponging, bouncing back and forth between the walls, that's the same thing that happens in a multimode glass fiber. What we call the index of refraction at optical frequencies is really the characteristic impedance at radio frequency. They talk about the index of refraction of glass or whatever. Well, that's really just describing its characteristic impedance to light, how it affects its electric and magnetic field. So yeah, what Wesley mentioned about the same thing at different frequencies is very much true. Very much true. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, basically fiber is just another dielectric. So, you know, you're dealing with electromagnetic waves of different speeds. The principle is the same. The materials have to be different because what works as a dielectric for one frequency doesn't quite work for other frequencies.
Questions?
Yeah, when we talk about the waveguides, the waveguide doesn't have to look like a piece of fiber or a rectangular piece of pipe. It could be a flat. That's what they use in electronics today, and it works. It is in your cell phone, Dr. Roy. So if you have a waveguide that is flat, that is made from dielectric material and another dielectric material, but they have a different dielectric constant, it is a waveguide. It is just TM mode that works in it, transverse magnetic mode or transverse electric mode or whatever the mode you it works for it. Now you have another flat waveguide, which would be the conductive surface and then the electric. And so you could have a copper and you could have a teflon, right? And then both of them together, as a synergy, they make the waveguide. Now it is important for you to know how to approach that waveguide, so you can put that wave inside to the waveguide. That is space between the dielectric and the conductive strata material is the highway for wide open highway for the electromagnetic wave to travel. So that's what is attached to all of the phenomena, the rules about the waveguides, from a surface plasma polariton to the scenic wave that is very low frequency, is actually the method of the mode that wave from the transmitter is presented to the waveguide. Am I right, John?
Well, okay. As I say, a waveguide usually is a type that does not propagate down to DC. So, in other words, like being just a guiding structure, And now, but don't confuse that, for example, with Stripline. Stripline, which is built, you know, basically with a PC board, where you have usually a ground plane, and then you have the dielectric of the insulator of the circuit board, and then you have the copper traces on top of that microstrip or strip line. That is more of a TEM structure because you have basically two conductors that will propagate down to DC. The true waveguide modes, like what you see in rectangular waveguide TE10, that has a cutoff frequency below which you can't propagate, like WR90, which is used up around 10 gigs. Okay, it cuts off around 6.5 gigs. You try to go below that, and nothing, very, very little signal gets through. Now, so depending how big you make the waveguide, I mean, you could make waveguide for 2 meters. It would be the size of air conditioning duct, but you could use it. It just would just be impractically large. That's all, right?
I see where you had it. I can agree with you, but you're missing some points. At first, oh gosh, it's 20 to 12. But it's very interesting. In transverse electric and transverse magnetic mode, we're talking about the mode, the wave is slowly pushed by grading at high frequencies. You have a grading, and that grading is actually pushing that wave inside that space between the dielectric and the conductive material. That is then the parameters of that grading that gives you ability to put that inside. We could put it in it. So you don't have to have a rectangular waveguide that is the size of a conditioner that is working at 2 meters. Although the way that the flat waveguides are used, and I would appreciate if you can look at that more closely, is actually going to gigahertz and use the frequency to terahertz and up to the frequency of light in nanometer, measured in nanometer. So you don't even have to have a typical fiber optic in order for the light go in it, because you could use another method of putting in inside, and as we're talking about the distance, it is just our convenience that we discovered that we could use the fiber rocket optic in that way that could give us long distances. But this is not the only one way to do it. Do you agree with that?
Okay, I'm not sure if I understand you, Wesley. Let me see if I have it. Yeah, I'm not sure if I understand. Now, I think, are you talking about some type of periodic structure that you place in the waveguide? I've heard, like a grating, I've heard of something like that with some of these metamaterials where they use periodic structures, repeating conductive insulating structures in various different shapes at a certain, you know, repetition, like a grating, as you say, that they provide a propagation mode. I'm not exactly sure how they work, but I know that they can get some unusual properties as far as reflection and signal propagating on them. Maybe that's what you're referring to. I'm not sure. I remember reading something about that. I was under that topic of meta materials, I think that was. But other than that, I'm not too sure about that. I don't know too much about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you started to talk about microstrips, and it's like a dog is a mammal, but human being is a mammal too. But they are two different species. So what is common to us is that we are mammals. but we are different species. We are not the same species, the same story with WebGuard. So they serve a very particular application. So how about you? Because the time is passing by, and now it's time for Paul to pick up. How about we do it this way? If you go to your browser, and type in YouTube surface wave, you're gonna find the lecture number 21, and that would be everything, and you're gonna see immediately recognize that this is about the electromagnetic surface wave, not mechanical surface wave. And then you're gonna immediately know that this is what you need to do. It's everything that you need in that lecture. But if you want more, I can send you to more materials of it. And now you tell me how much you disagree or agree with it, because I sent it to Dr. Roy, and he was a kind of in disagreement with it, which is okay, which is practically great. Okay, but for you especially, because you're interested in that area, I would appreciate if you do so. I mean, if you give me 2 minutes, I can give you the exact title of that video and to explain it.
Okay, Webby, I'll look it up. I'm going to check both of these. I'm going to check the Avramenko fork, and also I'll look up Surface Wave 21 and Lesson 21. And I'll comment on it next week. I'll do a little research on it to see what's what. Okay, I'm going to turn it back to Ned. I think good time is going.
Okay, I found that video. So the video is called Lecture 21, in parentheses EM21-Surface Waves. Lecture 21, in parentheses EM21. That surface waves, and this is it is a lecture by EMP possible, Echo Mary Papa possible, EM possible. So if you get into it, look at it, you're gonna understand it. You're not gonna have a problem with it. It shows the all of the wave types. The only thing is that I disagree at certain point. That's what he's talking about, the Zenek wave. So he's talking about the Dyakov surface wave, surface plasma polaritrons, excitational surface wave, survey of surface waves, and more. Back to you.
Okay, back to Ned.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, John. I'm looking forward to hearing your opinion about these things next week. And thank you, Wesley, as always, for participating and bringing all this new stuff to our table here. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. And now it is time for Paul WS2N to give us the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And good topics. And right now, I'm looking at an old magazine that I saved, Scientific American, from May of 1999. And the front cover has the picture of this star spacecraft. And they talk about what they plan on doing with it. It wasn't launched yet, you know. And then they talk about that it's going to be mounted to a Delta II rocket, you know. So it's an old magazine, but it has all the details about the aerogel and everything. But I saved this one. This one magazine had topics on a lot of the space vehicles that were going up at the time, you know, Chandra and the telescope and all the near spacecraft that went to the asteroid. landed on it. You know, it's got one topic after the other, so it did save that one. Anyway, quite a few little things happening. Nothing major in the space world right now. NASA is targeting the next. They targeted the next launch for resupply. That went off okay. The International Space Station. Before it docked, though, they needed to move the crew Dragon vehicle from the Harmony port. They needed that for the to unload everything. So they needed to move one spacecraft and make room for the cargo vehicle. To do that, they actually have to put the whole crew on board. So, which involved the two fellows that went up, the one Russian and one American, went up in the Dragon spacecraft with just two people on board. The reason for that is they're going to come back with four. The other two will be Williams and Wilmore, who are still stuck up there. They launched last summer. And they won't be coming back until February with these two fellows. But anytime they relocate a spacecraft on the International Space Station, you can't just put, like, let's say, the pilot in and just move from one location to the other. Because then there would be three extra people on board that wouldn't have a life raft if something went wrong during that one-hour procedure of going from one port to another. The NASA rules are, you know, for every person on board the space station, there has to be a seat for them in case, you know, there's fire or they get hit by space debris or something, and they lose vacuum. So they did do that. Four people got in, relocated to the space-facing port on Harmony, which left the other one open. You know, for the docking crew vehicle. That was it. So, yeah, an interesting launch by Rocket Lab recently was the ACS-3 solar sail. That stood for Advanced Composite Solar Sail System. They wanted to put this into orbit and see how it works. They've done experiments with these types of things before, but this one's a little larger. The idea is to use the light coming from the sun, you know, the photons, to propel a vehicle. So it's very light. I think it was a 12U model, very small spacecraft. 12U meaning, you know, 1U is 4 inches by 4 inches, 10, you know, 10 centimeters by 10 by 10, you know, CubeSat. Well, you know, put 12 of them together, and that's what you have with this vehicle. And the spacecraft got up there, and it opened up its mylar sail, and it's bigger than, you know, the average patio. It's around 30 by 30 feet. So apparently, it's still, you know, it is working. The main test was really to test the booms and the operation of opening this up. The idea is to make something extremely light. And then my law stuff is extremely light. And the boom that opens up are also very light. And they open up like a tape measure. You know, if you have like a 25-foot tape measure, that, you know, the way that those things roll up, well, when you roll it out, you know, it tends to come out pretty straight. It's that type of thing. So we'll see how that works. See if the sun is pushing it along. some kind of acceleration they can get out of it. Right now it's in orbit, it's not going anywhere. But they needed to test the mechanical ability thing to open up properly. And then they could, you know, make larger ones based on that whole design in the future. Let me just stand by and see if anybody has any comments. This is WS2N.
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Paul. This is Charlie. Good evening.
Uniform. Very good. Good evening. How are you doing, Charlie? Do you have any comments, questions or anything? Back to you.
Yes, we launched them yesterday. Now, they put up new cells, new cell plates.
Which one went up yesterday? Was that another SpaceX? Put up some kind of cell plate. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
It went up yesterday at 1:14 a.m.
Okay, I didn't follow that one, Charlie, but how did it go?
So far, so good. Now, you have 13 direct to cell. Okay? Is that just the cell phones?
Yeah, well, was that part of the Starlink? I think there was one that was supposed to go up for OneWeb. That's a different company than SpaceX that is involved with broadband communications, and I think they wanted to have cell capability as well. Maybe it's, I don't know which one, which company it was that went up.
That was Starlink. SpaceX launched a batch of Starlink. Now, I know about the satellites. I'm just questioning about the direct to cell.
Yeah, they're trying to do that on their newest version of the Starlink. They have tested it, and they said that apparently the test they made about, I don't know, 6 months ago worked out okay. So I assume that this is what they're sending up as well. But I think it's both. I think the satellites are broadband, like the 7,000 now satellites that they put up there. But I think the newer ones are supposed to have the cell capability. I know once the Kuiper system gets launched by Blue Origin, they already ran a test with theirs, and that was successful. They're going to be able to do, both cell and broadband. So, I guess that's the wave of the future. If you're in the middle of somewhere and you need cell phone capability, that would be the way to go. But from what I understand, all of this stuff is very expensive if you're going to pay a monthly fee. Back to you, Charlie.
What are they going to do with all these cell towers down here if they're sending cell capability up there?
Yeah, well, they're not going to do away with our cell towers, no. You only have about 2 million customers now signed up with SpaceX with their Starlink system. So 2 million, I think there's 2.5 million people. Right now there's billions of people that are hooked up to cell phones on the Earth right now. So, you know, one of the reasons SpaceX wants to increase the amount of satellites that are going to be up there is to increase the amount of people that could operate them at the same time. And he wants to go from 7,000 now to around 30,000. So we'll see if that ever happens. And even that, you're not going to be able to do what you can with the population on Earth operating right now, billions of cells right now at this second, compared to 2.5 million. There's no getting away from our cell towers, that's for sure, Charlie.
I do have one question. Now, SpaceX is starting to put out satellites down here. I saw it on my telephone. I was going to ask you about it last week. Is he trying to go into the TV business also?
Well, whatever he can do, I guess, with the bandwidth that he has. Just like cell towers down here, there are people that are watching TV shows through the cell system. So I guess he'll be able to do that as well. As long as you get the bandwidth. But yeah, no, I have not heard that is active at this time with Starlink. Right now, as far as I know, Starlink is just internet. Everything you can do on your computer. But so far, no cell communications. And TV, I guess, yeah, he'll be able to do that. To just use the same bandwidth that you use for the internet.
One other question. The new solar panels that they sent up to the space station, are they better than the old ones, and how?
Yeah, they call them ROSA, roll-out solar arrays, that are presently installed. They have one more set that they plan on doing. Originally, they wanted to do three. There's four main sections, four main groupings of solar panels that are on the space station. And each one of those, like you look at just one of, let's call it a wing. One wing that's up there, it's what, 40 feet wide, and I'm trying to think, around 80 feet, or I think long, a little bit. These are massive things that are up there, and then there's like, eight of them. You total them up, and it was enough to put out 160 kilowatts of power in all the years. So they tend to degrade over time. They get hit with cosmic rays and stuff, and they lose cells here and there. But, the power went down to around 160. Originally, they started around 200. So now NASA wanted to get it up to around 230 or more. 230 kilowatt power. But to do that, they needed either bigger cells or, high-quality ones. So they were high-quality ones, much more efficient than the original ones that were put up starting in the early 2000s. So these are much, much more efficient. I think they said around 30% more efficient than the old ones. So they did three sets, and then NASA says, well, you know what, let's do another one. I think they're waiting for another delivery in the near future to do another set, which involves usually two spacewalks. Two guys go out and they install all these brackets and everything. Where they put the solar cell is actually in front of the other solar cell. So you would say, oh, no, that's going to cut back on the power. Well, it's about two-thirds the length of the original cells, the length of it. A little thinner too, but much more efficient. So they're actually putting out, more power than the older ones, even though it's creating a shadow on the existing ones. And the ones that they hooked up so far are all successful, Charlie, and they got up to, I think, 230 kilowatt hours, or kilowatts, 230 kilowatts of power. They went from 160 to 230, and they plan on doing one more set, which will bring them a little bit higher. So it worked out, and they recharge these batteries that we talked about earlier. They used to be the nickel hydrogen batteries, and they're all gone now. And they've been replaced by Japanese-built lithium-ion batteries. So these solar panels are charging away. When there's daylight, and at night, the electronics change everything over automatically, so you don't know the difference inside. It's not like the lights blink or anything. And they work off the batteries for the other half of the orbit. So it works out okay. And NASA, needed more power. They're doing a lot more stuff than they originally planned on the space station. It's something like 300 experiments going on at a time on the space station. And many of these things need power. So that's what they do. They now have the power that they need. Back to you, Charlie.
I'd like to know the company that's putting out the solar stuff. Because I'd like to put solar on my house, but I don't know if I can afford that.
Yeah, I forgot the name of the company, but if you put in ROSA, R-O-S-A, solar panels for the International Space Station, you could find out who made them. You'd find out in about one or two clicks on Google. But they're not, as far as I know, doing domestic work. And these are very expensive, compared to what we would probably buy here on Earth. They're different. They roll out. I mean, they're actually, rolled up when they send them up in the back of the trunk of the SpaceX cargo vehicle. Then the robotic arm from Canada removes them, and then puts them in a proper location. And then the two astronauts who, earlier on, maybe a week or two before, install the brackets, go out and accept the roll-out solar array from the robotic arm, and they start attaching it to these brackets. After everything's attached, they release the strain on these things. And what it's like, there's no motor that rolls these out either. Let me drop it. To open it, they cut whatever's holding it. And, you know, if you you can envision like a, you know, semi-hard plastic tube, I think it's a carbon base, and, you know, you take this tube, and if you take that tube and roll it up, you know, because it's got the stiffness to it, if you release it after it's rolled up, it would, you know, the tube would force itself into being straight, and that's what it does, and that's how it, you know, you have one on one side, one on the other, and when they expand, it pulls on the solar panels, and it rolls down that way. You know, you can't roll it back up, but that's the way they do it. I remember years ago, the same company just sent one out as a test on one of the missions, just to see if it would work, and it worked fine. And after that, they got the contract from NASA to do all of these massive solar cells. But no, they're not making this be a house. Back to you, Charlie.
No, I'm looking at it now. Rollout solar array. Wow, this is. Rosa is flexible and rolls solar rays that operate the same way, measuring tape when you unwind it from a spool. Wow. I'm really impressed. I'd like to try this.
Yeah, I'm glad you found it. Yeah, and they officially call it IROSA, you know, IROSA, I for International. But so it's the International Rollout Solar Arrays. They're so successful that they put them on another deep space probe that's going to use them. So, you know, it's the wave of the future. They're going to have it on the... they're also going to have it on the space station that goes around the moon, the Gateway. This company has a contract to do the same thing for that one, you know, whenever that gets put into lunar orbit. So, yeah, it's the wave of the future. Instead of these massive panels that go up, you know, they're good. They have their purpose. Like the ones that just went off to orbit Jupiter, that's going to be going near Europa, called the Europa Clipper. Those things are, each one is 75 feet long, and I guess about 10 or 12 foot wide. And they're not the robot type. They're on hinges. And they'll open up with motors, and you know they also needed some strength behind it, because halfway out on those panels they're gonna have these dipoles that are gonna open up to 50 feet long, a little over 50 feet long. They're gonna be motorized, but they're gonna be supported by the solar panel itself, and it's going to be two of them, you know, one on, you know, you're going to have like a port solar panel and a starboard solar panel. So, you know, each way, halfway out, you're going to have this dipole that's going to be extended, you know, perpendicular to the solar array, of course. And those are going to be used for transmitting and receiving signals that it will be transmitted down to the moon of Europa to try to find out how deep the ice goes, you know where the liquid water starts that they know is up there. You know, it might go, you know, 6 to 10 miles down, and then they'll be able to tell from the transmitting. I think it's around 80 meters too that they're going to be transmitting.
you know, 3.5 megahertz. And then when the signal comes back up, the timing of that, they'll be able to tell how thick that ice is. But that's an interesting mission. But those solar arrays are completely different. They, you know, they're the, what you would call the old-fashioned designs. The Rosa ones are the new designs. Back to you, John.
You mean for ground-penetrating radar?
Yes, and they're using different frequencies, but I know 80 meters is part of it. And I guess they have it. They probably have some kind of a built-in antenna to them, because it's going to be, the antennas are 52 feet dipoles, you know. It's not like mine, you know, I have a 134 halfway dipole, you know, they couldn't do that. So they went for this other number, and that number is also going to be resonant for one or two of the other bands that they're going to use as well, besides 80. Back to you, Charlie.
I got a question on the ground penetrating radar to see what's under the moon, under the different planets. Now, is the ground on Earth is the radar going to go down and penetrate to these planets at the same rate, at the same frequency as up here on Earth?
Yeah, well, we use it here, but, you know, they have so many different types of satellites that are up there doing that. I'm not too sure what, yeah, I'm sure they have something like this. I'm not sure what frequencies they use for it. They have different kinds of satellites here. They have massive antennas, antenna reflectors, you know, sometimes like, you know, 75 or 80 feet diameter. There's another one that was launched by Delta II, I think that was 120 feet in diameter. And they open up, and then they have just a receiver, and they're able to pick up the ground signals when they transmit down with this big dish antenna. So it's done differently. Where Europa Clipper is just using these massive dipoles, I guess it would be too involved to, you know, design that type of antenna for going around Jupiter, or, you know, I think over 40 orbits, many, many years. So, you know, it might be different there. They're going to have to use 80 meters, because that penetrates the ice. You know, they'll know how far down it goes, and when it hits water, it's going to change. You know, the frequency will change, so they'll know how deep it is by how long it takes for the frequency to change. You know, then they'll know they're hitting water. So that's what they want to find out. You know, how deep the ice is. They could do that on other moons too, but, you know, right now they're just going to worry about Europa. I think the JUICE mission by European Space Agency has something similar to that, different antennas, and they're going to be looking at the ice and everything on a different moon called Ganymede, also around Jupiter. So that's on its way to Jupiter now as we speak as well. So we got to wait around 6 years or so. I think we got to wait for these vehicles to get to Jupiter. I think it's 20, 2029, 2030. Back to you, Sean.
Now, with this ground-penetrating radar, can they tell if there's other stuff down there, like metals or... like caverns? If they're looking for water, but can they tell if there's a cavern down there or other metals like gold or silver or things like that?
No, they... No, not with that. They will be able to tell maybe some elements that come out of the surface to see. What happens is the they don't have like earthquakes or they don't have volcanoes like we do, but sometimes the water will actually shoot up through the ice and the spray, and it happens quite a bit. So they think that it's possible that the timing is right. Spacecraft could be going past the at the right time, and that there's going to be detectors, what do they call it, neutron spectrometers on board the spacecraft, and it'll pick up whatever molecules might be floating in the atmosphere above the moon of Europa. And if that's true, that they pick it up, they might not only detect water vapor, but because it's coming from deep on the ground, let's say there's phosphorus or something like that, yeah, then they would be able to detect that, but not with the radar. Back to you, Charles.
I was just curious to see what else, they're looking for underground.
Yeah, I don't know. There's 10 different instruments, everything from cameras to radar. There's 10 different science experiments on board Europa Clipper. And I remember looking at them, and they're quite involved. I'd have to be a scientist to figure out how those things work. So they're gonna find out a lot of stuff, and I'm sure they'll give us a lot of detail on what equipment they use to find what when they get there. 6 years from now.
I got one other question. I don't mean to disturb your subject for a second, but the Chinese are setting up, getting ready to launch a rocket in China in 10 minutes and 44 seconds. My question is, how come we never know what's on their rockets?
Yeah, there's a lot of countries that launch things that they don't want everybody else to know what's on there. We do the same thing. In fact, some of the rockets that go up, from the Defense Department or NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, they spend billions of dollars on these space launches, and they're putting up, spy satellites and all kinds of stuff. They're launching from American soil. We have no idea what some of the government agencies are putting up. The same with China. They just don't release information. We know, for instance, their crew just went up not too long ago. A new crew to the Tiangong space station. They have their own space station. They regularly fly 3 people on board their space station. We regularly have 7, but they have 3. They stay for 5 or 6 months, and then a new crew comes up, and then the old crew goes down. They just did that about a week or so ago. So we know about that. So we know some of the launches that are going up. and they have had a history over for decades. They've been launching since the 1970s, and they have a history of keeping things quiet. And then if it gets into space and it's a science type of mission, or a communication satellite, you know, then they'll say it was successful. And then what they used to do is if it failed, they just want to tell you what it was. So it's like, you know, we always have successes. I wonder why. Back to you, Charles.
Yeah, but could we be doing kind of like the same test?
Well, test, yeah, it could be. And then it could be communication satellites, could be weather satellites, you know, spy satellites. Look, you know, I mean, right now China, well, they had a rover riding around on Mars looking for evidence of water. Their rover quit working, but it was up there working for quite a while, a solar panel rover. But yeah, they would be looking for similar things that we have already found. So, you know, there's definitely duplication involved.
WB2BXO,
good evening, Frank. How are you?
Yeah, very good. I wasn't sure I'd be able to get in here edgewise. May I add a couple of comments?
Oh, sure. Go right ahead, Frank.
Yeah, okay, very good. I think it was Charlie, I think, was asking about putting solar panels on his house. And if it was someone else, hopefully they're still listening. But anyway, my understanding is I've never been in a position to do that, first of all. But my understanding is that, yes, you absolutely can do that. And in many places, the power company is required to buy back the power you generate. In addition to letting you know excess power, and in addition to letting you use the power for your house, the problem I've noticed is quite a few of these companies going out selling solar panels for the house seem kind of scammy. At least in parts of Philadelphia, they seem to hire legions of college kids every year to try to sell to everybody, including people who are not really qualified customers, as they say in business. And as people who live in apartments and can't possibly install solar panels. So my impression is you have to be really careful and look that you're dealing, make sure you're dealing with a legitimate company and not a 20-year-old kid working for one of these scammers. And I think somebody asked earlier this evening whether that one that crashed where the parachute didn't open was using aerogel. My recollection is it was, but maybe by now somebody's looked that up. Anyway.
Nap time complete.
That's what I had in mind. WB2BX.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that was the Genesis mission. And, yeah, they thought it was going to be a complete failure when it smashed into the Utah desert. But they did manage to save it. And I thought I remember aerogel. I don't want to say that for sure. I was going to look that up later tonight. But, yeah, okay. The solar panels, you know, so many people around here have them, one guy down a block. When he first moved in, one of the first things he